Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Welcome back as we continue our discussion of gender norms and roles in our four NICE selections this year, Jane Eyre, Gone with the Wind, Little Women, and Dracula.
We also, as we think about this book being about coming of age stories for four, it is actually a coming of age story for Laurie as well. Let's
yes, it is.
About his gender roles.
Yeah, we need to talk about Laurie and Professor Bear and John Brooke. And they won't be as long discussions as our girls because we love our girls. But a little gender bias there on our part. But yeah, Laurie is such an interesting character because he is. I remember one time years ago, I counted how many chapters he was in, and I think it was almost all of them. I mean, he's in a lot of chapters for a not super, I mean, he's not one of the March sisters, you know, which are the four focus people in the book, but he is a very big part of the story. His role in the story is interesting because he does kind of create conflict, you know, because of his feelings for Joe that are not reciprocated. He tends to try to be helpful in all the wrong ways, you know, just, you know, as this rich kid, he thinks he can just make everything okay. And that's just not really how the March girls operate. And then of course his developing relationship with, Amy and his genuine, you know, love and sadness when Beth dies and his love for her and how he really truly sees her as his little sister. I think of all of them, she is the most sisterly one to him. I think he kind of sees Meg as an older sister, but you know, when at the end when he and Amy come home and they're married and he and Joe kind of agree that they have a brother-sister relationship, not really. I think they have a friend relationship. I don't think he really sees Joe as a sister like he did Meg or Beth, you know. It's more like what you talked about in our romance thing, the friend zoned relationship, you know. Okay, this romance didn't work out, but we're still friends, you know. You don't normally call that person a brother or a sister, you know, because that sounds a little, you know, but they definitely have a friend zoned relationship. But I think his character goes from kind of that young, impulsive, impetuous, rich boy, you know, young Anakin Skywalker kind of brat, you know, to grow up to be a much more thoughtful, mature, kind man, you know. And again, a lot of that is due to, you know, enduring heartbreak, or what he thinks is heartbreak, when Joe doesn't love him back, and then when Beth is dying and he is the one who goes to, you know, comfort Amy and keep her informed of what's going on when they don't want her to come home for that. I think those experiences cause him to be a better man.
Right. Yeah, I find interesting about Laurie, one way that he defies the gender norm is that he does have a few guy friends, but for the pivotal part of his childhood, he selects four girls as his best friends and closest confidants.
Yeah.
And he never challenges that Joe can't do what he can do unless it's just kind of the friendly friend rivalry. He sees her as an equal from day one and admires her. And so I really like that about Laurie.
I do too. I think that's a good point, one I hadn't thought of until you said it. But yeah, that he chooses to spend his time with the girls when he, I mean, any rich young man with a giant house, like, you know, the Lawrence's mansion, he would have male friends coming over. I mean, he would have school friends, and I mean, he would, because that's what rich guys did. They hung out together, right? You know? So I think he's yearning for something that they represent as a family. also, not just their individual personalities, which he likes all of them for their own qualities, right? All the girls. But there's something about their life that, you know, in the early parts of the book, we know he's like kind of seeing out his window into their window, watching their lives happen. And there's something about this lonely little boy, and I say little, even though he's maybe, you know, he's like 15 or whatever. He's a lonely kid whose parents are dead. You know, his grandfather is loving but distant. You know, he's a lonely kid looking into this warm, you know, I picture this window with the golden glow of the fire and the lights within and this happy little family in there. And he doesn't see their poverty as such. He sees their happiness and their familial joy. And that's what he's yearning for.
Right,
and so,
right.
You know, he wants to be a part of that. And you know, in the early scenes, he kind of inserts himself, you know, in their doings as much as he possibly can. And they're just nice enough and sweet enough and wonderful enough to welcome him. You know, and they like him. They think that's great. But, I mean, it is a little weird. It's a little unusual. It's a little outside, like you said, outside the gender norm for a young man of his social class and everything to be doing. But it's written very well, because you see him wanting it, trying to be a part of it, not sure if they're going to accept him, and as they do and he becomes more comfortable with the family, it just becomes a beautiful friendship between all of them. And I think his role in the story is really important, not just as an eventual spouse for Amy. And, you know, before that, a potential, you know, boyfriend for Joe in some weird way. But just as the outsider looking in but becoming part of the family, he is us. We are looking in and we become part of that family just as he does. I feel like that's a technique that Louisa May Alcott, I've always wondered if she did that intentionally. If part of the way she wrote his character was to simulate our responses to that family. How we want him. And I mean, I don't know anybody that's ever read this book that didn't feel that connection in some way.
That's true.
To some level. I mean,
that's true.
So
no, I think you're exactly right. Yeah. And you're right. That's a great entry point character at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. He is our vehicle into their lives even more than their own thoughts are in some ways.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Excellent point.
Yeah. What about Professor Bear? We got to talk about him a little bit, because he's an interesting character. Because now we're talking about gender norms, but it's hard not to talk about gender norms without a couple of other things. I think as a man, just as a man in society at that time, he's fairly normal. The things that set him apart are the things that he's from another culture. He's an immigrant. He's a foreigner. And in the story, you know, he's so much older than Joe, that affects how she and we see him at first as a romantic partner, potentially. So it's hard to take him as a male character without looking at the class hierarchy stuff that has to do with foreigners and immigrants and ageism in terms of romance and sexuality and all that stuff. But to try to just look at him as a man, he's a professor, he's a teacher, he's living in New York, he's tutoring, he has nieces and nephews or whatever, nephews I guess, not nieces, I don't remember, yeah, nephews, that are there with him at some point. So he's an interesting character because what we know about him is not as much as we know about a lot of the other characters. I mean, we know some about him, but we don't have the depth of his character that we do with, say, Lori or even John Brooke in some ways.
We get him in an information dump in about one chapter.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, a little bit of action that happens after that. But a lot of what we get is Joe's like, here's a billion letters. I'm writing all about Professor Bear. But yeah, no, what I like about him is that he is nurturing. And I'm like, that's more of a feminine quote quality. I think that he's really our teacher. He even likes to serve as a teacher to Joe, which can feel a little strange when you're talking about that age difference there. And when he's giving a kind of roundabout lecture on what she should and shouldn't write.
Or read. Like she,
or read.
You know, like we talked about that before when he tells her to read Shakespeare and stuff, and we're like, does he seriously think she hasn't read Shakespeare yet? I mean, she, you know, it's a little condescending, some of his, you know, and again, I don't think necessarily that Louisa May Alcott intended it that way when she wrote it. It's just the perspective from the modern viewpoint, it comes across that way a little bit. And I think that's interesting with Professor Bear, because although he is like a strong, intelligent, he's educated, he's a professor, he's strong, he's kind, he's loving, he's, like you said, he's a nurturing person. Mm-hmm. Like Amy, those are things that you wouldn't normally see in one character of that time period. Men would either be strong, intelligent, you know, teachers, whatever, but maybe not so much nurturing and kind and thoughtful, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's a combination character that pushes the boundaries of what would be the norm. Much like some of the older men that Louisa May Alcott knew when she was growing up, because, you know, she knew all those great literary figures and had crushes on quite a few of them, you know.
And with the presentation of masculinity we have and the main male characters in the other books, there's a lot of dignity involved. Mm-hmm. And a lot of dominance.
Yeah.
But with the dignity, we are allowed to laugh at Professor Bear. Joe is laughing at him fondly in these letters right from the very beginning, like how, you know, he'll mismatch something he's wearing and, you know, poor thing can't get his socks together. I can't remember what it is.
No, yeah, I know what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like down on his hands and knees playing around with the kids.
Yeah.
And so this idea that he can let go of this dignity, I appreciate.
Well, and there's also the element of, and we probably should talk about more about this in the sex and sexuality part, but it is relevant to gender norms. You know, Rhett Butler is handsome. He's charming. He is a force of physical nature in women's eye. Women respond to him sexually, right? Dracula is the ultimate seducer, right? The ultimate charming seducer. Rochester is described as somehow alluring. He's not classically
he's
handsome, but he has some charisma. He has a way of drawing women want him, and it's not just for his money, right? Professor Bear is described in absolutely the opposite way. We are told he's not attractive. He's not, you know, sexually alluring. We're told that. And I found, I've always thought that was really weird. It was almost like Louisa May Alcott was like, you know, maybe subconsciously saying, those men that I admired when I was, you know, in my real life, I didn't admire them sexually, you know? I mean, I don't know. I always felt like that was such a weird thing for her to, you know, to actually, and Lori makes fun of the way he looks. And, you know,
it's true.
You know, it's very odd that his physical self is denigrated the way that it is, and he's not that classic leading man, charming, handsome. I mean, she could have very well have written the same character, a kind, fun-loving, let go of his dignity, educated, immigrant professor, but had him be handsome, had him be physically attractive. She didn't. It was almost like she had to create a character so far outside the romantic lead norm for Joe.
Yeah.
That he had to be so different. Only Joe, this misfit herself, would be attracted to him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it's very strange.
Yeah.
But it works. I mean, it makes that, you know, it makes it work. So I guess we have more to talk about Professor Bear in future episodes, but that's a pretty good way of looking at him in terms of how he fits the gender norms or not of the time.
Sure.
I think John Brooke is probably the most stereotypical, one-dimensional kind of classic of the time period, husband, you know, friend, family friend, husband, hardworking guy. He doesn't ever do anything that is out of the ordinary or unexpected for who he is in society, who he is in, you know, the relationship to the March family. He is their steadfast, dependable friend who becomes, you know, the March's son-in-law when he marries Meg, and it's a very appropriate, they think it's all a very appropriate relationship and everything. So there's not too much to say about John, except for that from a modern standpoint, some of his words and tones and a little cringy in the paternalistic air, you know, condescending area. But other than that, you can't really fault him. He's a decent guy, you know.
He's a decent guy of his time period. Yeah, absolutely.
And he genuinely, genuinely loves all of them. I mean, he would lay down his life for the father. He would do whatever it takes to help Marmee. He would defend Joe, Amy, Beth, and Meg to his dying breath. I mean, and obviously he's going to care for his wife and children till the day he dies. You know, I mean, you could plug him in to a modern story of the hardworking, quiet, you know, steady husband, father, son, friend. You know, I mean, he is who he is, and I love him. I think he's great. In spite of those cringy moments where he's kind of condescending, you know, again, I think that's a time period thing. I think you know, if I'd read the book, if I was alive when the book came out and read it, I don't think I would have seen him that way at all. It's a modern perspective looking backwards. But I've always really liked him a lot more than I like Lori most of the time, and a lot more than I like Professor Bear most of the time. So he's easy to like, you know. What's not to like, you know? And he's kind of good looking too, you know. So.
And apparently, Alcott really liked the man that she based him on, her older sister's husband.
Yeah,
so she really
admired and respected him, and it comes through. It definitely does. So
Absolutely. You know, it is interesting that we've talked a lot about the huge age difference in our main character couples, but there is an age difference between Meg and John.
Yes.
And you particularly see, like, when he kind of proposes in a way where it's like, could you ever be interested in me? And she gets all shy and like, I'll be patient. And you can see the age difference.
Yeah, because he thinks really he's too old for her. I think he thinks she could be attracted to Lori. I think he thinks Lori's a more appropriate spouse for her, you know, and she's, you know, that's not at all. She loves him. She definitely loves him and has for a while by the time he proposes to her and everything. But, it's a much smoother telling of their relationship in terms of that age difference, because at least he acknowledges it.
Right.
With Rhett and Scarlett and Rothschild, or Rochester and Jane, they don't even acknowledge it. It never even comes up, you know, that these men are so much older than, I mean, it doesn't come up between them.
It does.
When?
It doesn't, Jane Eyre. Yeah, yeah, but I wouldn't say that it's like a major barrier.
I don't think it comes up as a reason why they shouldn't love the guy. Like, Rhett actually says, "Why don't you try marrying someone who knows his way around women?" You know, I mean, he's suggesting that his age and experience is a bonus, right? And I don't think Rochester is like saying his age is a negative. John literally is saying, I you know, I'm old and you're young and you deserve blah blah blah. I mean, he's kind of alluding to the fact that age could be a problem, and she's like, no problem, I love you, you know. So I like them. I think they're good.
Yeah, I think they are within the time period.
Yeah.
I think they're a very nice couple.
Yeah. I do too. Yep. I agree. I think we should probably wind up this episode.
I think we should.
I think we have to.
Stay tuned. Yeah. Our next episode, we're going to cover sex and sexuality in these four books.
Ooh, bring your ice packs, ladies and men. We're gonna be hot and heavy. Yeah, it'll be fun. Yeah. Oh, that was fun. This has been At the Round Table with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org. We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.